Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm rebroadcasting the first half of an interview I did with the extraordinary Betty Garrett, who I am so sorry to say we have recently lost. Betty Garrett, star of everything, and who is so terrifically missed, not only by those who knew her, but by those who were lucky enough to see her on stage, in film, on TV. Betty could and did do everything it is possible to do in the area of entertainment, and managed to be at the same time an extraordinary friend, mentor, mother, grandmother. So this is the first half of the interview. I will be playing it and also cuts of Betty with a variety of other stars. And next week, the second half. But hang on. Here come Betty Garrett.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
Show. The Lynn Show is all about being who you really are, without guile, without dissembling, without spin, without embarrassment, without pretending. The old what you see is what you get view of personality. Very few, maybe almost none of us, is actually living all of who we really are. And I am both pleased and terrifically sad to be saying that the interview I'm playing today, the first half of which I'm playing today, is with Betty Garrett, who was, as far as I can tell, exactly who she was. Betty was simply a warm, generous, available human being. And this is, of course, not speaking at all about her extraordinary talent, which was everywhere. You'll hear her say that she started out thinking that she wanted to be a dancer, although she was already singing and learning to play some instruments. But that quickly morphed, and she became an actor, a comedian, a singer, a dancer, a composer, a writer. Truly, if there's anything you can do with talent, Betty did it. And with no... I don't even know what the word is. There was no artifice to Betty. She was simply who she was. And it made her not only extraordinary as a performer, if you saw her on stage or screen or TV or you heard her sing, but as a person, she was right there with you, always, listening, responding, just Betty. And I met her because I was writing a master's thesis on successful people in show business, successful women in show business, trying to figure out how they did it, no doubt. And a friend suggested that I talk to Betty and gave me her number, and she was completely open. She just talked blithely, bluntly about her life and how she became who she is. And you'll hear that quality in this half of the interview, and also in the second half of the interview next week. She is self-deprecating. She can make fun of herself. You're getting tired of hearing all these wonderful things about her, I know. But, well, I can't help it. So I'm going to play the first half of this interview, and I'm also going to play, I think, three songs that someone did a compilation of Betty Garrett, songs that she wrote and songs that she recorded, and I am lucky enough to have it. So the first song I'm going to play right before I play the interview, and it is Everything I've Got Belongs to You, with a very young Betty Garrett and a very young Milton Berle. And following the cut, Everything I've Got Belongs to You, you'll hear the first half of my interview with the indescribable Betty Garrett.
Oh, Betty G.
Yes, Milton B.
Gee, you look awful pretty.
Thank you.
It's a lovely hat you're wearing. What did it cost you?
$55.
$55? Are you kidding? You could have got a new one for that.
How dare you?
Don't stamp your foot at me. That's impolite. To stamp your foot at me is not quite right. All I discover is you're not so fine. I fear my lover is a swine. I have eyes for you to give you dirty looks. I have words that do not come from children's books. There's a trick with a knife I'm learning to do. And everything I've got belongs to you. I've a powerful anesthesia in my fist.
You mean in your head.
And the perfect wrist to give your neck a twist.
Don't you try to make up with me.
There are hammerlock holes. I've mastered a few.
Not with your muscles.
And everything I've got belongs to you.
Share for share.
Share alike.
You get struck each time I strike. You for me.
Me for you.
I'll give you plenty of nothing.
I'm not yours for better, but for worse.
Worse is right.
And I've learned to give the well-known witch's curse.
You know, you look like one.
I've a terrible tongue, a temper for two.
For ten.
And everything I've a got belongs to you. Let's hear from you.
I have eyes for you to give you dirty looks.
Which one, the good one?
I have words that do not come from children's books.
The ones that abandon Boston.
There's a trick with a knife I'm learning to do. And everything I've got belongs to you. I've a powerful anesthesia in my fist.
In the fist, she says, in my fist.
And the perfect wrist to give your neck a twist. There are hammerlock holes. I've mastered a few.
What are you, a lady wrestler?
And everything I've got belongs to you.
share for share.
Share alike.
You get struck each time I strike.
You for me, me for you.
I'll give you plenty of nothing.
I'm not yours for better, but for worse. And I've learned to give the well-known witch's curse.
Whatever happened to Spike Jones?
I've a terrible tongue, a temper for two.
And everything I got belongs to, everything I got belongs to, everything I got belongs to you.
Wasn't that fun? You get a real sense of who Betty is from that, and almost all the songs I'm playing give you that sparkle, that giggle, that amusement that she had really all her life, at least all the part of it that I knew her. And so that was Everything I've Got. It was written by Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart in a musical called By Jupiter, and was recorded in, I think, 1947. Ooh. Anyway, now that you've heard her sing, here is Betty Garrett.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with Betty Garrett in her home, which is under, well, not under construction, but under renovation in preparation for our wedding.
Right.
That's going to take place in a short period of time.
Right, yeah.
We've been talking about how it's whenever you're going to have some event, you suddenly see all these things that need to be done, and
and it makes you get them done.
And it makes you get them
which
done.
Which is a blessing.
It is a blessing.
Yeah.
Okay, so Betty was asking me what we would talk about, because I know Betty now for about 25 years, I think.
Right.
And we've talked about everything.
I think so.
So I'm doing this series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have an agenda, really, and I don't have questions, but I'm asking people to talk about how they became what they are, how they put together a life of using their art. And my God, you have done this all your life, have you not?
Well, I guess I really have. Looking back, my mother and father divorced, and she moved up to Seattle, and she became manager of the sheet music department in a big music store in Seattle called Sherman Clay. So I kind of grew up in that store. And it's no wonder that I gravitated toward music, because there was all this music, and the top floor was every piano, you know, Steinway, Bechstein, you know, all of you name it. And then the next floor were musical instruments, and there was an instrument there that fascinated me. It was called the theremin, and it was a big box with a rod on the top and another rod on the side that regulated the volume. And when you turned it on, the closer your finger got to that big rod that was sticking up, the higher the tone. Well, that fascinated me. And then I got so I could play the pagan love song was my specialty. And what is really remarkable about it, if you'll just look in back of you.
Yes.
It's not the big box anymore.
This is it? This is a theremin?
My kids got me that for my birthday. I kept telling them, if you ever find a theremin any place, I would love to have it.
Oh, my God.
And by God, they found me a theremin. So I am still kind of trying to get back to the pagan love song. I can do pretty well on Amazing Grace. That sort of works. But I'm not going to show you, because I'm not good enough yet. But, you know, that was my, and I could play the ukulele. I learned to play the ukulele. And then on the ground floor were records, phonograph records, and they had little booths, and you could go in and sit and listen to whatever record you wanted to listen to. And then where my mother worked was the sheet music, and these long, long banks of wonderful sheet music. I have some of the covers over there by the piano that are framed, because they were little works of art.
Yes.
And my mother would go in to this little room with the piano, and customers would come in and give her a piece of sheet music and say, what does this sound like? And she would play it. And I would stand in the corner and listen. So I guess, in a way, that's what started me particularly in music. Although when I first started really interested at all, it was in dancing. And I went to a wonderful teacher called Marianne Wells in Seattle, Washington. And there was a red-headed boy who used to stand in back of me and make fun of me. And his name was Marcel Leplat. And he later became Mark Platoff in the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. Then he became Mark Platt. And Mark Platt was in a number of movies. I think one of his most famous things was in, I think it was Tonight and Every Night with Rita Hayworth, where he did a whole ballet thing about Hitler, who was the dictator. And I do remember
that. I think I do.
Now, what was fun about it is later on, my husband Larry, and he did a picture with Rita Hayworth, and they sang duets and trios with Rita. Wow. And when Larry and I were married, I still call him Marcel, was my daddy, because I didn't have anybody out here that I knew that long. So he stood up for me and was my daddy.
Wow.
You asked me this question, a long-winded answer, but all of these things kind of contributed to the fact that I guess I was meant to do this. Oh. In school, I was always the one who said, you know, you do this and I'll do this and I'll play the ukulele and you dance. And with my twin cousins that I spent summer with a lot, I would always do that.
So it's, let's put on a show?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was, I know when the last play that I did at the Annie Wright Seminary in Tacoma, where my high school, the bishop, we did Twelfth Night, and I played Mariah, which is one of the best parts because it's funny. And the bishop came up to my mother and said, "What are you going to do with your daughter?" I think he asked it sort of like, you know, if you don't do something, she'll be a gangster's mauler. You know, it was that kind of question. And my mother said, "What do you think I better do?" And he said, "I think you better put her on the stage."
But you're kidding.
And I'm not kidding. You said, my mother said he said it in that way, as though you better do that or she's going
to
get out of hand.
To save her, you know? Right. So a question I had was, did your mother encourage this?
Oh, absolutely.
So when the bishop said, I mean, it wasn't like he had to convince her to put you on the stage.
At that point.
And how old were you when that happened?
I was 16. I graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. I was 16. The thing was that I did everything when I was a kid. I wrote. I drew. I didn't know whether I wanted to go to art school or journalist school or what. And I got I got very good grades. I look back and I wonder how that happened. But anyway. I got good grades, so I got, you know, entries to, I think, Stanford. I just thought of the other school, which was a very high-class girls' school. But when I got this scholarship to the Neighborhood Playhouse, my mother she really took charge in that. She just felt that was the best thing for me to do. Because I had been taking a lot of dancing, and Martha Graham was one of the teachers at the Neighborhood Playhouse, and I had been studying in summertime in the University of Washington with a number of her students, and her group actually used to come and teach. And so I think by that point, what I really wanted to do was be a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really the reason why I wanted to go to the Neighborhood Playhouse, because Martha Graham was a teacher there. And I think my mother knew that that was the best place. If I'd gone to the University of Washington, I would have majored in boys. You know? But going to the neighborhood playhouse, which was 9 to 6 every day, and you took one or two really stiff dance classes. I used to get so stiff sometimes I couldn't get in and out of bed. But, and then you had speech, you had acting, you had Shakespeare, you had choreography, all of these elements.
You had no time for boys.
No, well, there were boys there I had time for. But usually we were doing scenes together.
Right.
And every once in a while you sneak off and steal a kiss or so. But the thing was that I really wanted to do that.
Yes.
I realized looking back that that was something, was a passion for me, and I think that's important.
It's so interesting because it sounds, when you describe it, like you weren't conscious of how much you wanted it.
Yeah.
But you wound up in it anyway, and then discovered that it was what you needed to do, meant to be.
I think that's absolutely right, and I thank my mother for somehow knowing that was the right way.
It's so interesting.
Guiding me in that direction.
Because so many parents would have chosen Stanford, you know, the University of Washington.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Had she wanted to be on the stage, your mother?
No, my mother was raised a strict Baptist. And dancing was a sin.
Oh, my.
And she used to tell that her whole courtship with my father was sneaking off to go dancing. He was a terrific ballroom dancer.
So she was a little bit of a rebel, your mother.
Yes, so she, I think that's one of the reasons that she, her dream was to see me dancing, because it was prohibited in her family.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But it did, so I want to say set the stage for you to... And so I imagine that she was so proud of you.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And I think I fulfilled a lot of dreams for her, which is wonderful. I think about her so often, she gave up a good job in Seattle, Washington, went to New York with me with no job, and she had a friend who came with us, and they shared rent of an apartment, so that made it a little easier. But she took a big chance. Because she was so knowledgeable about music, she got a job very quickly with Shermer, mm-hmm. which is a big music publisher. So she did all right, but it was a very courageous thing for her to do.
Yes, and very, very much about you. And
yes.
Not about her.
Yes, I think about that a lot too, because I think about my kids. It's always been divided mm-hmm. in my life, and I feel sometimes that I don't give myself completely to my family the way my mother gave it to me. But at the same time, I feel badly that my mother didn't have other things beside me.
You know, it's what I'm thinking is your mother's childhood denied her permission to be who she was.
Yeah.
So she gave you that permission.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In an ironic way, her childhood predisposed her to deny herself and give that to you, but your childhood predisposed you to feel entitled.
Yeah,
you know
that. I love your whole explanation. it makes me feel much better.
Well, you know, and I want to say something else about it. I want you to. I don't know exactly how to say this. I haven't said anything about you in terms of this interview. I haven't told the audience anything about you. Mm-hmm. And at some point soon, I would like you to describe what your career has been. Mm-hmm. You're a national treasure, Betty. I mean, you... Oh. No, it is absolutely true. you have given pleasure to millions and millions of people in every possible venue that there is. You just continue to do it. So if the universe was watching, I'm sure it said to your mother, give this one all you've got, because she's going to give it all back to the world.
Oh, that's nice, yeah.
You know?
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. You know, maybe we could just interrupt this here a little bit for you to talk about, just to give a kind of chronology of your career.
Well, from Annie Wright Seminary, which I've gone everywhere on scholarship. I had a scholarship to that, fortunately. And as I say, all during my childhood, I went to a small boarding school, and I was always the one who was telling all the kids, you know, you do this, and I'll do that, and we'll put on a show. And
a natural director.
And I started to also do monologues. And I lived in this little boarding house where there was a darling, lovely lady named Margaret Bateman. I'll never forget her. Big, tall, gorgeous face. She had a sort of look of like a Katharine Hepburn, that sort of look. And I used to do these monologues. Where in hell I found them in my head was like a Swedish woman getting on a bus.
You mean you invented them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I would just improvise them. And I gather the other kids around me. I was the oldest one. I was 13, and they were all 8, 9, and 10. And I'd make them sit and listen. And I'd do this. I remember this one about the Swedish woman on the bus. And she said, you won't let me take my little dog on the bus. You know? And I'm getting off the bus. And I did another one about my favorite thing was to play the demonstrators in the 10-cent stores who say, now ladies, you will take the powder and you know. And I did that whole thing. And I invented these things. And Margaret Bateman, who was one of the heads of this little boarding school, came to my mother and said, you should take her to see Ruth Draper.
Mm.
And Anya Enters, I don't know who you know.
No,
Anya
I don't.
Enters was a dance mime. And how Margaret Bateman knew about these people, I don't know. And so my mother did. When they came to town for concerts, my mother took me to see these people. When I saw Ruth Draper standing up there doing what I love to do, is making up these wonderful dramas, just one person. And I think that planted something,
yes,
in my head.
Well, it confirmed for you that your instincts were right on.
Completely unconsciously, believe me.
Yet again.
None of this was conscious.
But it's yet again, there's some thing.
The thing is, going from then the Annie Wright Seminary to my scholarship at the Neighborhood Playhouse, 2 years of studying with people like Sanford Meisner, Martha Graham, Louis Horst. We had Margaret Webster teaching Shakespeare, who was the authority on Shakespeare in those days. And, I mean, wonderful, wonderful people. And I had 2 years of that. Then my very first job was kind of two jobs at once. Martha invited me to be with her group in a concert where she had one big number she was doing was an augmented group, so she needed about 4 or 5 extra dancers, and so I was not made part of the group, but I was part of that auxiliary group. So I got to do two concerts with her, and one was at Carnegie Hall.
Wow!
And it was on New Year's Eve, or no, Christmas Eve. And someone said to me, "Oh, you poor thing, you have to work on Christmas Eve." And I said, "Are you kidding? I'm dancing with Martha Graham at Carnegie Hall. What a Christmas present." But at the same time, I got this nutty job with Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater.
Oh, my God.
And I'm just a kind of a walk-on part. And actually, it became more than a walk-on because it was in a show called Danton's Death, which was about the French Revolution. And Orson had dug up a whole center of the stage, the Mercury Theater, with steps that went down into the bowels of the basement, you know. And most of us all stood down there underneath making noises and singing songs, you know, like, come dance the Carmagnola and wait for the gun and wait for the gun. And doing all kinds of noises and down with Danton, up with Robespierre, you know. And one of the things that is my favorite story is one night in rehearsal, our rehearsals were crazy. We would rehearse from 6 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning.
Holy cow.
And I'd stumble home and sleep all day. And we got $15 a week for that. Anyway, one night, Orson, whom I just loved, one of the most picturesque people I've ever known. At that point, he was a tall, slender,
handsome,
darling guy with a baby face.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I want noises over a village at night. So people were, you know, he said, one cast member said, a dog barking, you know, and Orson said, that's good, that's good. Somebody said, people snoring, and, you know, so forth and so on, crickets. And I lifted up my hand. I said, a baby crying. Mm-hmm. And he said, good, good. Let me hear. So I went, like this. And everybody laughed. And Orson got furious. He said, don't laugh. That sounds exactly like my new baby daughter. So I became the baby cry. And one of the cast members was Joseph Cotton.
Oh, my.
Who became a very famous actor after that.
Citizen Kane.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And many other wonderful...
But I mean with Orson.
Yeah, mm-hmm. With Orson. And Joe Cotton said, sex noises in the night. So Orson, of course, loved that. He said, well, let me hear you. So Joseph did all of this sort of, oh, yes, you know. And Orson said, great. The only trouble is, after about 2 or 3 weeks of the show down here in the basement in the dark, Joe got very bored. And so his sex noises, be like, ah, yeah, woo-hoo, ah. So anyway, that was my first year out of Neighborhood Playhouse. And when you consider how lucky I was dancing with this wonderful dancer and part of the Mercury Theater, unfortunately, Danton's death died. It did not run very long. But then I seemed to go from one thing to another. One of them was into the World's Fair, the 1939-1940 World's Fair. That was a huge pageant about railroads. And they had an actual railroad yard on each side of this enormous stage. It was outside. And there were like bleachers looking at the stage part. And these locomotives would come racing across the stage. And it was the history of railroads. So there was the Tom Thumb engine. And all around that, the choreographer had choreographed a wedding party, and the Tom Thumb came on, and the whole wedding party, and we all danced and did a big Strauss waltz around the so-called station,
mm-hmm.
and then put the bride and groom into the little train in back of the Tom Thumb, and it pulled off. Then there was the one of the most touching scenes is a big yellow boxcar, sort of. That was supposedly had been the car that took Lincoln's coffin across the United States. And in that scene, we played farmers and
a grieving nation.
Yeah, and people would come up and touch the boxcar and stuff like that, and the train would slowly go off. And there were all these different scenes, and... The second year, I played that for 2 years, We were off during the winter months, but then we would come back in the summer. And the second year, the director decided to do a cross-section of a club car on a modern train. So the engine was a huge actual train, you know? Mm-hmm. And it would come on, and it would be drawing this club car. And, of course, one side was sliced off so that the audience could look into it. And there were people there having drinks and the waiter waiting on them. And then it came to the end of the car, which was a little...
caboose?
No, it was the end of the club car was a little cabin. You know, the trains at that time did not have the berths or whatever you call them. But this was a little private room, which the trains had. And my job was to come in with the porter, and he would bring in my bags, and I would tip him, and he would leave, and I would take off my hat and put it up, and take off my jacket and hang it up, and then take off my blouse and hang it up, and slip down my skirt.
You're kidding!
And I did this very modest striptease. I rolled my stockings down very seductively, and I would get down to my brassiere and panties, and I would reach back and start to take off my brassiere just as the train went off. I would say, I'd tell this story once, and I said, so then the train would go off, and he said, and half the men in the audience. Anyway, it's very funny because years and years later, there was a big, what was the magazine? Was it Vanity Fair? One big magazine, and I don't think it's in print anymore, but they did a whole article about the 39-40 World's Fair. Mm-hmm. The title was, That Was a Fair That Was, yes. Because it was a great fair. And in the article it said, I wanted to go see Gypsy Rose Lee in the entertainment section, but my parents wouldn't let me do that. They took me instead to the radio, to the railroad show, which they thought would be very educational. And he said, I got to see striptease anyway. But I love that. He didn't remember my name or anything like that. He said, I got to see this girl do a real striptease.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you're just sort of riding this magic ride into show business.
Yeah, it seemed to me that I never went very long without some kind of a job. But I think, I know in between the 2 years of the World's Fair, I got a job as a chorus girl in the Latin Quarter in Boston. And I often think about my mother, how she let me do this, because that's a little different than getting a mm-hmm. concert with Martha Graham. And by that time, I'd had enough of all kinds of dancing mm-hmm. so that I could be a chorus girl. And I went up to Boston, and they had digs, as you call them, in England, for girls in the chorus who from out of town, a place, a wonderful old brownstone front house called the Charlotte Cushman Club. Mm. And it was for young theatrical women, it was called. Mm. And so I was put up there, and I shared a really nice, big, huge room, but with two other girls. Mm-hmm. And I think we paid...
It's a little like stage door.
I think, yeah, very much. And I think we paid $12 a week for that room, But divided between the three of us, it was only $4 a week.
Wow.
But I only made $25. So, but that was really fun. The thing that's funny about it is that after a couple of weeks, Lou Walters, who's now very famous because Barbara Walters mm-hmm. talks about her father, he, of course, owned the Latin Quarter, and evidently, I think it was his wife, Barbara Walters' mother, who said, that chorus line looks like a bunch of hookers.
Ooh.
And said, you should get rid of them. They, you know, they're too old for this, and they, you know, they look coarse. And so Lou Walters said, okay, we'll fire them. He said, you can keep that little girl on the end that swings her behind. That's me. And I don't know, somebody else told me this, so that's, you know, I'm
so quoting. Did they fire everybody and keep you?
They fired everybody. And the thing that was sad about it is my two roommates were really accomplished tap dancers, mm-hmm. and I wasn't. And I'd make these two poor girls at night teach me the steps because I just didn't know enough about tap dancing. And they got fired. And I felt so terrible. I said, I'm quitting. And they said, don't be silly. We'll get other jobs, you know. So I stayed on. I was there for the whole winter.
Just and you?
No. They brought in a whole new line of girls.
Oh.
And they were actually, I don't think they were much better than the ones we had, but they were favorites of the patrons, who a great many of them were the Irish Mafia up there in Boston. And so there were a lot of gals who, you know, knew these guys who had come into the club.
Yeah.
And so we had a whole different line, chorus line, but I was still there.
Wow.
And so I stayed, and I was there for for one whole winter. And I finally came back home.
When you came home to New York, mean, right? Were you living with your mother?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my mother had an apartment, and we had an apartment. And so, as I say, it surprised me that she let me go off to Boston mm-hmm. and work in a nightclub. You know? But there was fairly strict regulations. You had to sit with customers who requested you, but you did not go out with them. I mean, maybe some of them did,
right.
But
you didn't have to. That wasn't part of the job.
You didn't have to, no. And I certainly would not have, wouldn't have wanted to. I remember one night, two guys asked for me to sit at their table. And I swear one of them looked just like George Raft.
Huh.
And we were sitting there, and I'm sure, pretty sure they were part of the sort of Irish mob.
Yeah.
And this one guy kind of started to come on to me, and the other guy said, just like George Raft, I swear, said, leave the kid alone. She's a good kid.
So you were protected in so many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It was probably the year after the World's Fair that I started to go up to the Borscht Circuit.
Mm.
And a place called White Roe Lake was my first job. And I was part of a little dance group. And I think we worked for $65 for the whole summer.
Wow.
But you got your board and room.
Oh, yeah, and it was wonderful up there.
And it was great. And we did wonderful shows. And Danny Kaye had been one of their staff, and he used to come up there a lot, and he would be part of the shows. And he saw me do a couple of things, so there was a little, they didn't call it Off-Broadway then, but it took place in a little theater in the Barbizon Plaza Hotel, and Danny recommended me, having seen me up at White Roe Lake. So, that Danny kind of became my mentor. He was really, always boosting me. And so one summer, I went up, I think it was the first summer that I went to Tamament, which was the famous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, that wasn't in the Boer Circuit, it was in Pennsylvania.
Right.
But,
and it's what Dirty Dancing is based on.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, Danny used to come up to Tamament a lot. And his manager, a man named Lou Mandel, mm-hmm. lived in a little adjoining community that used to be like permanent residence in the summer, and that was Lou Mandel. And Danny told Lou Mandel, he says, watch this girl. So Lou started watching me, and the next thing I know, Lou is advising me and became my manager.
Wow.
And was my manager until he died. And now Milo, his son, whom I knew at 4 years old, is now my manager.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Again, it's like this, I don't know, you know, it's like you float from one thing to another.
Exactly.
You know, I've heard this a lot from people who have really made a life in show business, as a performer, that things dovetail for them, that people do things for them, that things show up.
Yeah.
It's a kind of meant to be.
Yeah, it is a... I really don't understand it. Because, I mean, Lou took such good care of me. He always kept an eye on what was really right for me. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when I got married... Larry inherited Lou, and then what saved our lives really was when the blacklist came along. By this time, Lou had gotten Larry into the building business. Lou had been in real estate in New York and understood real estate very well, and Larry, after the blacklist, could not get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So Lou began to involve him, and Larry became really a builder.
Wow.
He contracted all these buildings. He learned how to do everything, do plumbing, he could do gardening, he could do repair, you know, anything. And so that really stood us in good stead.
But again, here it is, you know, this Lou, I mean, this
That's
is not
right.
a traditional... This is not a traditional thing that managers
do.
No. You know.
And Lou and his wife Ruth just became like family.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he was very involved that we should have plenty of financial backing, you know, and particularly came in handy when Larry couldn't get jobs.
Right.
And the whole market kind of changed anyway, so I think every artist should have some kind of income that comes from someplace else, because you can't depend on financial support as an actor or an artist.
Of any kind.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, I decided to interrupt the interview at this point for... no good reason, except that I'm running out of time, and there's enough of the interview for me to be able to to air it in next week's show as well. So if you want to hear how the rest of Betty's life went, at least up until the time of my interview, which was, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago, please tune in again next week and listen to the rest of the interview and also two more songs with Betty in them. I'm going to play two more before I close out this show. The next song I'm going to play is called Yes Indeedy, and it's a young Betty Garrett and a young Gene Kelly, and it comes from a movie called Take Me Out to the Ball Game, the title tune of which I'm going to play next week. They're doing that as well. And this is This says not only something about, you know, Betty and Jean, but so much about what our world was like when Betty began performing. This is all from the 40s, the movies in the 40s. And so here, Jean Kelly and Betty Garrett in Yes Indeedy.
¶¶ indeedy, yes indeed, we sure make hay. Yes indeed, yes indeedy, we're the greatest lovers in the USA. Now you tell them first, Betty.
Oh no, Gene, age before beauty.
Well, thank you, child. I kissed a gal in old Wyoming. She rode a horse in a Wild West show. When I said, baby, I'm Ben Horn Roman, she cried, we just got started, and she sighed, we can't be parted, but I left her brokenhearted at the rodeo.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
The boy said no. Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeedy, I left a broken hearted at the rodeo.
My turn now?
Proceed, proceed.
Well, I kissed a boy way out in Boise, in Idaho, where potatoes grow. I went away and his thoughts were noisy. I said, I'll see you later, and I hopped the nearest freighter, left him holding up a tater down in Idaho.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed. He's left with his potatoes down in Idaho.
Very interesting, very interesting. But I kissed a gal way down in Texas.
I kissed a guy up in Tennessee who loved a gal that lived in Texas.
Well, should she live in Dallas? Was her home just like a palace? Tell me, was her first name Alice?
Yes, sirree.
Why, that must be the same girl.
Naturally, naturally.
Bless me.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeedy. Alice moved from Dallas up to Tennessee.
I kissed a guy from old Nevada.
I kissed a gal out in Iowa.
That's nothing. I kissed a guy in Colorado.
Well, I went out with the lassie that I met in Tallahassee.
I went steady with the fella who was born in Pocatello.
I've gone with gals from Birmingham.
Got guys all over Alabama.
Amarillo.
And Savannah.
Terre Haute.
In Indiana.
We're the greatest lovers in the U.S. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. We sure made hay. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. We're the biggest liars in the U.S.A.
So, not only is that adorable and charming, but for me, bringing back memories of what was a much more innocent time when Betty and Jean were making movies and recording. And so, as I said, I'm rapidly running out of time in this show, and I want to close the show with one more song. This one with Betty and her husband, Larry Parks. It's called Reckon I'm in Love, and yet another throwback to a more innocent, sweeter time. But before I play that, I want to tell you that Josh Hackney is the guy you want. If you have any questions, concerns, confusions about the internet, computer, recording, electronics, because he is the guy who makes this show possible. He fixes the sound to the extent that it is possible to fix it, and he explains to me everything that I need to know that I don't know, and then he re-explains it to me when I have forgotten it, and he's recently made me a new computer. There's just nothing he can't do with this. So again, if you you want him, you need to go to The Lynn Show, THELYNNE, don't leave the E out of Lynn, SHOW, and at thelynnshow.com. You can also learn anything you want to learn about me. And you can hear all the old shows because all the podcasts are up on thelynnshow.com. So, as always, I hope that you heard something that interested you, compelled you, amused you, reminded you, something that'll bring you back. Because, as always, I will be here next week, and next week, the next half of the Betty Garrett Memorial interview. I hope you'll be there with us, too.
Mighty pretty moon tonight.
Yeah.
Like a little music?
Yeah. Get out your guitar. Where are we going?
Mighty pretty moon tonight.
Same old moon looks new tonight. Reckon I'm in love. The same old stars look twice as bright. Reckon I'm in love. You won't believe the crazy things I've been dreaming of. I feel as though my spurs are wings. Reckon I'm in love.
I met a certain someone who makes me feel that way.
Who's that?
And ever since I met her, I'm a singing in the saddle, scaddle, diddle, doodle, daddle all day.
I saw her paw and he said, son, what you thinking of?
I told him, put away that gun.
Reckon I'm in love.
Get out here in the desert.
Rustlers. I find I shave most every day.
Reckon you're in love.
My little red book, why I chucked it away.
Now I know you're in love. I haven't slept the way I should on that moon above. And yet I wake up feeling good.
I reckon you're in love. Kissed her once and I saw stars. Love hit me that way.
And ever since she kissed me, I'm singing in the saddle, scattle, little doodle, daddle all day.
I laughed at guys who feeling cool, all that love it does. But now we're talking that way too. Reckon we're in love. Reckon we're in love. Reckon we're in love.
Well, ain't we?
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we're